Want to learn more about the unknown ladies of architecture? Then I recommend you listen to She Builds Podcast, where we tell the stories of remarkable women who have shaped the design and construction industries.
Hi, I'm Jessica.
I'm Nurjiti.
And I'm Lizzie.
After we graduated from Syracuse University School of Architecture, we set out to learn and share the untold stories of women that traditional school curriculum left out.
One day, there's an announcement on campus that women had been seen wearing, quote, inappropriate clothing. Gasp!
What the heck does that mean?
Yeah, so it turns out that Ruth and her fellow classmates were these women. They had field classes where they're doing welding, forging, and foundry work, and obviously they have to wear jeans to those classes instead of, like, dresses or whatever else.
While Gertie was in school, she wasn't just going to classes, trying to stay alive like some of us. I know that was me in school, just taking it day by day.
Yes.
But not Gertie. She became the president of EVIGOL, an honorary association of Cornell women architects.
Of course she did.
These are stories not taught in schools. Women who've molded the world of architecture, construction, and development for over a century.
From Jane Jacobs to Ray Eames, She Builds Podcast explores the legacies of trailblazers. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform.
Let's fill the gaps in history together. All you have to do is follow the link in the show notes and subscribe and be part of a movement to expand industry narratives.
Hello, hello. Welcome to Tangible Remnants. I'm Nikita Reed, and this is my show where I explore the interconnectedness of architecture, preservation, sustainability, race, and gender. I'm excited that you're here. So let's get into it. Episode 7. Welcome back to another episode of Tangible Remnants. I'm excited that this week we're actually going to travel outside of the U.S. to the beautiful island of St. Lucia, where I talk with Jermaine Joseph from the St. Lucia National Trust. I met Jermaine at a Association for Preservation Technology conference, APT, last year, and I was so thrilled to meet another woman of color in the preservation space, particularly someone who's working at a national trust in a different country. Talking with Jermaine at the APT conference is what inspired me to really start taking the steps to make this podcast become real. And so for that, I am forever grateful for her encouragement and support in doing that. So our conversation is wide-ranging, and we cover a number of different things, including the preservation of cultural heritage in the Caribbean, as well as the impacts of tourism on cultural heritage, colonization, slavery, colorism, climate change. We cover a number of things as the conversation was just flowing. You'll hear my ignorance about St. Lucia come out a couple different times, and Jermaine is gracious enough to teach me more about the culture. And a couple of the things that came up for me in this one was just a reminder that when taking a global view that not every Black person in the world is African American, there are different narratives, histories, and stories that exist for Black people of color around the world. So just a heads up, this episode contains some explicit language, so if you have any little ones around, you may want to grab some headphones. A little bit about Jermaine. She holds a BSc degree in architecture and has 6 years of work experience in conservation and preservation of cultural heritage. She specializes in built heritage and is currently managing a register of 250 historic buildings for listing, while also developing draft legislation for the preservation and conservation of the historic buildings. She was recently certified in museum conservation skills and values heritage management at the University of the West Indies in conjunction with the OAS. And she's also taken on a curatorial role at Walcott House Museum, which is the birth museum of the Walcott twins, Sir Derek and Roderick Walcott. Her current research interests include cultural heritage management, museum heritage management, heritage interpretation, anthropology, archaeology, and the restoration of built heritage. She was also awarded a 2019 fellowship with the Museums Association of the Caribbean for her work at Walcott House. And since her term with the St. Lucia National Trust, she's been able to marry her passion for architecture with her fervor for cultural heritage and preservation. She is an absolute joy, and I'm so excited to be able to share this conversation with you. There are a couple different links in the show notes to a couple of the projects and sites that we talk about on the podcast, so be sure to check those out. And remember, you can like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow the podcast on Facebook and Instagram using the handle Tangible Remnants. This week's episode is sponsored by Smart Chief Architects. Smart Chief Architects is a course that I created to help architects better manage their small practices. And you can find out more information at www.smartsheetforarchitects.com. And if you enter in offer code TR podcast, as in Tangible Remnants podcast, then you can get 20% off any purchase on any of the courses. And without further ado, let's get into the show. So one of the reasons why I wanted to chat with you, aside from you being amazing, was the fact that you're in St. Lucia doing historic preservation and dealing with a lot of the issues of climate change and telling different narratives of different histories. So I'm just so excited to hear more from you about that. My first question then is, what are some of the preservation issues that you're finding in St. Lucia?
Thank you, Nikita. Yes, lovely St. Lucia, the Caribbean island, the Helen of the West. We have a lot of issues. I think I don't even know where to start, whether we start at the top or the bottom. I mean, the first one is that our policies really do not encourage the preservation of our historic assets, be built or tangible or intangible. There isn't a lot to support that. And we are seeing the repercussions of this because we're losing a lot of our cultural heritage really quickly. Some of the challenges that we face involve just basic awareness of the importance of our heritage, what it means, and embracing it. And when I say embracing it, I mean the narrative of, you know, slavery was a major issue, well, obviously for everyone, and it's not readily embraced here. So all of our monuments and all of our sites do have the backdrop of slavery. So it's not very pleasant to embrace that. So we're finding that everything that's cultural heritage is seen as derogatory or negative. And that's number one when it comes to our preservation of our historic structures, our cultural heritage.
Mm-hmm. And so then are the monuments and things more so celebrating, I guess, the slavers or the captors as opposed to any of the indigenous people from the island?
Absolutely. It's, you know, when it's interpreted, it just negates the complexity of our history. And for me, that is an issue. And, you know, we're slowly waking up to that fact that everything represents the colonizers' perspective. You know, the forts are built and there are narratives like there was skilled labor building the forts, and there are no names listed. We have no idea who this skilled labor was. I work at Pigeon Island National Landmark, and it was a military site. So there are numerous buildings on site, but they're all interpreted as Mr. Walter Rodney, who was responsible for the Battle of the Saints. And there's no back history of the Amerindians who lived here, the Taino who were here. There's, you know, all of that complexity has just been erased. So it's told literally from one side. And of course, the trust is starting to try and bring that narrative in, but also it has to seep into our communities and into, you know, the residents, people who, and we need buy-in, but we can only start to tell the stories. We St. Lucians, we see our historic site as a recreational area, not necessarily a place for communing with our past or understanding our history.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah, I know in the States we have, I guess we have a mix of them. Most of the sites are more commemorative, but there are a number of like national parks where the focus is more so on recreation as opposed to the history of what happened in that space. In terms of, I guess, the recreation, so is it kind of like weddings and family gatherings and that kind of recreation? Or is it, okay.
Beach picnics, events, the St. Lucia Jazz Festival is held here as well. And it's very scenic and you would never, and that also lends itself to negating our complex history. You know, we never see it as a place of education and taking apart the past. And so I think sites like that should really sort of jog our memories and help us remember. As a result of being a touristic site now, St. Lucia has had to, there's a conflict now in the use. That is where our heritage comes in, and that is where the St. Lucia National Trust and other heritage organizations have been able to come in, because our sites are being used, it's touristic values, and then we're ignoring, almost disrespecting the heritage, cultural heritage sites. So there's a conflict that has started because of that, and it's allowing the trust and other organizations to say, hey, wait a second, we need to address this.
Right. Yeah, because I can see that being a problem where if it's people who are visitors to the island wanting to party on a site that really should be hallowed ground, and then the conflict of, well, they're paying us money to do this, and the money and the revenue, wherever that goes. So yeah, that can end up getting very complex very quickly.
Yes. Yep.
I know when we were previously talking, you had mentioned that St. Lucia has been colonized by the French and the British multiple different times. And so there are overlapping narratives and, I guess, conflicting narratives of how you tell that story. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. So we St. Lucians have this narrative that we were seven times British and seven times French. And that's where our history started. And this is why I'm saying the narrative is so, it's so constricted that it's ignored the Taino and the Amerindians who were there before. And in this narrative now, being, we have this confluence of the French and the British, and our architecture is a mix of the French and the British. And I was speaking to someone the other day and saying it's such a synchronicity in it. It's so subtle that you have to actually look, you actually can't see the divide because it's married so well. Mm-hmm. And that in itself has given St. Lucia a unique architectural style, which doesn't really have a name right now because it's come from the French and the British. You can't say it's British colonial and you can't say it's French colonial. So we're still defining that language, but we have that as a unique part of our cultural heritage.
So then the architecture that is down there, are you seeing the effects of climate change or kind of rising sea level or anything like that on any of the historic resources and historic architecture that is trying to be preserved, and how is that being handled?
Well, we're casting a blind eye, and Nikita, I hate to say it, everything indicates that some of our sites will be under sea level, you know, in the next, I don't know, 20, how many years, but all the indications are there. All the research is showing that, and we're not at the moment considering how we're going to address these issues. Right now, it's not on the table. The discussions are not happening, but it doesn't ignore the fact that the research is there showing that, you know, most of our sites will be underwater.
Is that conversation happening anywhere on the island, like maybe just not in heritage, or is it kind of still being ignored?
Yeah, it's happening on the island. You know, our people are not reticent of it. It's not resonating. It's still something that's in the past, even if the hurricane seasons, I mean, we have five hurricanes right now out there in the Atlantic, you know, our climate has definitely intensified. And we've recently had, you know, some historic forts collapse. I mean, the evidence is there, but nobody's paying attention.
Oh my goodness, that's petrifying, but then also somewhat comforting to realize that there are other people ignoring in other parts of the world, like it's happening in America here as well. So I don't know, it's kind of like misery loves company, I guess. It's just,
It's so sad. I mean, you know, there are ways of mitigating and addressing, you know, people considering moving things, but we're just not even having the conversation.
Wow. Like, I wonder, like, what do you think it's going to take for that conversation to come more to the mainstream?
I think awareness. I think we need to start educating people and start giving people more real life stories and start showing the data in a more real way that relates to them, that helps them relate. I don't know if it's visually or if it's something like that, you know, because right now it's just on paper.
Okay. Sorry, this is just fascinating to me because it's, in my mind, climate change is so real, so imminent, so concerning. And so just kind of knowing that St. Lucia is an island, I think it'd be more of a concern.
Square miles, not much, not very big.
And wait, how big?
238 square miles.
Yeah.
Going to be affected.
Right. Oh my goodness. So then what got you into the heritage space in St. Lucia?
Right. I listened to your first podcast, Nikita, and I was just so inspired because You know, I feel like heritage found me. I studied in the UK, learned architecture and design, and came back to St. Lucia and realized quickly that our cultural heritage, that meant a lot to me. And, you know, when you leave your country and you go abroad and you see other people showing reverence and appreciating, it really does put a new perspective. And of course, being a foreigner in another country, you do appreciate your culture. So I came back and started this blog, and I should have made that correlation. My blog was called Colonial Impressions because I really wanted to understand the physical as well as the intangible, the physical aspect of our heritage, our cultural heritage, our built heritage. And just finding out about these buildings, which had this mix of Gothic architecture and British architecture and, you know, fretwork that's designed to keep out bats. You know, there were just all these amazing tidbits in terms of the construction. And so whilst I started digging, I realized this is definitely somewhere I feel comfortable. And since then, I've just been following your footsteps, really.
And so I remember how excited I was to meet you at the APT conference last year, because there's not that many Black women in preservation, particularly at APT, because APT were kind of the nerds that are like, oh, how do you fix the brick and the mortar? And you were more in the technical piece of it. And I embrace that. It's fine. So I was so excited to meet you, and I just really enjoyed getting to know you more and more of the work that you're doing. But then I'm wondering, when did you start working at the Trust?
6 years ago.
Okay.
They needed a program officer for built heritage because the policies were not in place, and they needed to start a listing of buildings. We up until 2014, we hadn't had an official register, so I was taken on board to do that.
Okay.
So since then, we've compiled a register of historic buildings. And as I said in the beginning, Nikita, the support policy-wise is not there. I mean, it has been submitted to the Development Control Authority, but we're still having some issues in having the list adopted formally. And in the meantime, we have like 1% of our built heritage that's still experiencing climate change, experiencing degradation. You know I'm preaching to the choir, but there's so many amazing techniques that these buildings represent, the material that they used, most of it is local wood, and the process, it's immaculate thinking about how these buildings have been put together.
Wow. And so then, are you finding that most of the sites that you're listing on the register are still privately owned, or are they owned by like the government or different companies, or what's the ownership structure like?
A lot of them are privately owned, and not just that, they're not being taken care of. So we're losing quite a few. We've had some successes in that Sir Derek Walcott's house, which is the Booth Museum of Sir Derek and Roderick Walcott. The government worked with us on that to preserve it. And I'd love to see that model sort of for all the rest of the buildings. But yeah, there's always that friction between the privately owned buildings. And there's a lot, I'd say like 70% of the buildings are owned by.
Gotcha. So about 70% of the buildings are privately owned. I wanted to circle back real quick, just because I'm curious. So as we were chatting earlier about the kind of the narratives and the difficult history around slavery on the island and all of kind of all the related issues to that.
Yeah.
And this is going to show my ignorance of St. Lucia a little bit, so apologies. So were there like big plantation houses with slave quarters?
Yes. There were plantation houses, there were aqueducts, just 2 weeks ago we discovered, I guess, because it's been there, a slave quarters. And like you say, you know what, I get emotional when I think about it, because we're uncovering all of this, and there's the sordid history, and then there's the careful design in which these things were built. So there is a sort of yin and yang thing going on, where like I'm really excited to see this detail, how this window was done, but I know it was part of a mechanism to incarcerate my ancestors.
Yes.
So there's that, all of that dichotomy. And there's a plantation house. There's a gentleman who at the moment, he's preserving wooden heritage. So he will find a historic building, and if it's at threat of demolition, he would purchase it and then reconstruct it on a site. I mean, I'm not sure how she's about that, but at least it's being preserved. He reconstructed on a site, and then he offers, it's part of his tourism product. Mm-hmm. And still, the narrative of slavery is not in that conversation. It's like, oh, it's a pretty building. It's a...
Right.
No.
Right. We have that same issue in the States, where it's the... Everyone wants to glorify the big, beautiful plantation house, but then they don't want to talk about the small slave quarters behind it. And they don't want to acknowledge the fact that the big house wouldn't exist without the little house. And there's kind of this whole false narrative around the Southern gentry and how they were such gentlemen and they were, you know, these upstanding citizens. But the fact that they were kidnappers and rapists and murderers and all of that is brushed aside. So it, and oh my gosh, and I totally understand the conflicting interest when you're discovering or uncovering the different historic heritage, because as the designer, the architect, the preservation specialist, you're excited about this has been here for over 100 years or however long, and it's like a direct connection to the past. But then it's also the what happened here, and knowing that this was a place where our ancestors or people who look like us were not treated well. And I understand that issue.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, some of the, we've got a site called Mont Fortune, and there are probably like 6 or 7 military buildings there, and they were all ballast from the ships that carried our ancestors. So they would put the bricks in the bottom of the boat with our enslaved people, and then once they offloaded everyone and the bricks, they would put tea in the bottom and whatever supplies that they got from here. And these buildings were built from the bricks that came down as ballast. So it's it's very, you know, it's chilling to think about it. But, you know, that it is what it is, and I believe in telling the story fully, as opposed to just having it blindsided and one-sided.
Yeah, exactly. Because I feel like it's, oh my gosh, sorry, so many thoughts right now. Because by not telling the full story, then we create so many false narratives. And there's so many people who think of history as one-sided, or that only one group of people contributed, or that, you know, others did not. And typically it tends to be white people were this great civilization that did all these fantastic things, and everyone who's not white owes white people a debt of gratitude because white people saved all these savages and all the other bullshit that is just not true. But like the way that the history is written is, of course, written by the victors. And so that's the story and the narrative that's been passed around. But it's interesting to me that that's happening in St. Lucia. And maybe it's also, again, me showing my ignorance of the island. So thank you for bearing with me as we're working through this. But I guess I always assume St. Lucia to be a predominantly Black island. And so it's interesting to me, or actually, let me stop there. Is that even true? Yeah. Is St. Lucia predominantly Black?
No, it's not.
Okay.
We've got a system, I would call it. I think we had spoken about that briefly, where the word black, it doesn't, we have a different, what I would call a different form of racism here. It is racism, but our society puts it into the bracket of colorism or shadism. So there's a caste system, a color system where, you know, the lighter you are, the higher up, or the more clout you have in this community, on this island. So, and this happened because the plantation owners started mixing with the locals, and also Martinique started mixing with the French started mixing with the British. So it's this melting pot. So there's a gradation of color throughout our society, which dictates who gets what. And then it also is underpinned by your name. So the family name also sets up this whole system, which is systematic racism in my mind, but it was a different angle.
It's fascinating. Particularly so in America, the general rule of thumb is if you have one drop of Black in you, you're considered Black. Mm-hmm. If you look like you're not pure white, then you're considered black. You're treated differently. I mean, you know, even Obama, he was mixed, but he looked black. So he was treated as a black man. So it's a, but I think that's fascinating that it's, oh man. So it's so
common. We have been treated like somebody of higher, in a higher class than, you know, somebody who's darker skinned, and you know, it's, you get that. I have friends who say they got into the party because they were lighter skinned than that person, or perpetuates. And then of course there's the the other side of this, which is this whole system that's being set up now, where tourism is our major income, and we're back to the same sort of plantocracy where we're serving white people and tourists as better than us. So we get the menial jobs, we get the menial positions, the cleaner, that, you know, this, the cleaners, the, I'm not saying that they're, we're arguing that why can't we be part of the higher echelons of these organizations? Mm-hmm. You know, why can't people be educated and have a place? Why are we constantly creating these jobs that don't empower our people?
Yeah, that's wild to me. Like, it's also just the a reminder of how effective colonialism was at positioning the narrative that white was the highest level.
Yes, and we're always in servitude.
Yeah. Wow, that blows my mind. And one of those, it's one of those things where it's like, I know, but it's also like, oh, damn. It's the reminder of it. I'm also recognizing that I'm thinking of this with a very American context. And so when I'm thinking St. Lucia is a very black country, it's a, or black island, it's a, well, yeah, because the one drop rule. So basically everyone in my mind in St. Lucia's, or majority, is probably black, but you're like, well, there's levels to this. And that's so true. And so it's just reframing it. That's fascinating. So then this is just me being nosy. What are the different levels of black referred to, I guess? Like in the US, it's like,
oh,
people are black or like African-American typically. So I guess what are there different names for different levels in St. Lucia?
It's so derogatory, Nikita, so derogatory. So we have what we call the Chabins, which is a French word, which means that you're like really pale skin and you've got what they call nice eyes and good hair. So that's sought after. So in St. Lucia, they call you a Chabin. And then there is, well, the brown skin is more of a Jamaican term that we've adopted. And there's a really derogatory term which shouldn't be that way, because they call you a Negmawa. Now, this is a mixture of our French background. So a Negmawas were people who would give the French and the British hell. Okay? So they've translated that into something negative. And, of course, having the word neg in there from Negro is confusion of, okay, so you really... the darkest skin of and black. So yeah, those are the various terms that I used to describe. But back then, I should say, in the 1960s, when all of this stuff was going on, I mean, they still use the word Chabin, not so much Negmaw, but yeah, just to give you a small indication of the systematic, you know.
And in America, I guess the Chabin would be a lighter skinned black person, or sometimes called a red bone. Okay. My dad was a red bone, and he was very light skinned, and it was, anyways, that's a story for another day. But it's also considered passing for white, because that was something else that lighter skinned people would do, because if they were able to, then of course they had different access to different levels of society.
Yeah, it's so complex. It does really tie into, you know, our heritage and how we perceive things, and you know, how we. Yeah, for us in St. Lucia, anything that was associated with the Negmawa, we weren't even allowed to speak Patois in the 1960s. And I think, you know, that really did a number on us psychologically in terms of embracing our culture and heritage. You know, it was our mother tongue. It was how we expressed ourselves. I mean, even when we translate Patois in Creole into English, it doesn't feel right. You know, there's a rhythm, there's some part of us that's in that culture, so in that language, that it was broken out of us. So we were told to speak the Queen's English, and you know, all of that just kind of in my mind has done a number on us accepting, you know, the better parts of our cultural heritage, for want of a better word.
And so then you're saying, like, in the 60s, that was the charge to just speak the Queen's English as opposed to Patois?
Yes, there was. That was the time of Windrush. That was the time Sir Derek and Roderick Walcott was speaking and writing about our folklores, because there was so much that we had inherited from our African ancestors that we brought with us as part of the transition, this transatlantic slave trade. So the Taino were here, and then the Africans came in, and the Africans and colonial masters came in, and the mixing started happening. But there's so much of our culture that is African-based. So Derek Walcott and Roderick Walcott were leading the charge in those days to infer that there should be some importance to our language, to what we eat, to how we dance, because, you know, it's important and it was relevant. So I think we spoke about how Sir Derek was talking about, in those days, you could not compare a mango to an apple, because mangoes, breadfruit, all of these things were slave food, right? So him and Roderick started idealizing the breadfruit, the mango. They started painting, because it was just, all the scenes that we had were, you know, of British countryside, British landscape. So they said, you know what, I'm going to paint pictures of the sea and fishermen and waterfalls that we have, you know. And they started idealizing our cultural heritage. And that wasn't an important step, I think, in the 1960s for St. Lucia. But it has moved on since then, unfortunately. We're still looking for the next Walcott and the next, you know, the next Roderick and Derek.
There's so much to unpack there, because it's always the idolizing the other, you know, or idolizing the British, or looking to, and I don't know, I mean, I'm kind of impressed in one of those, like, how in the world that tiny little island of England conquer so much of the world and all that, but anyways, but just like the idea that looking to something other than what was on St. Lucia was appropriate or important. But then I'm glad that they started to be like, no, we have beauty here. Yeah. We have amazing cultures and traditions here that need to be celebrated. And we don't have to be like the British. There's no reason that we have to ignore what's here. Oh, my gosh.
I mean, you know, they spoke of birds. They went full on, like, with nature, you know, talking about, there was something called a Malfini, which is a generic bird to St. Lucia, and they created a whole play around it. You know, it wasn't about the nightingale or the blackbird. This was in the 1960s. They were actually even writing in Creole and putting that in their plays. So it was a full-on, listen, this is important, and we're highlighting this. And I respect that. And I really wish we were closer to that in this day and age.
Right. How have you seen the tourism industry impact the island or any of the cultural heritage stuff that you're working on? Or are there specific ways that the tourism industry is impacting that?
Good Lord. I was supposed to say you just opened a can of worms there, girl. Yes, it's phenomenal. There are three developments happening right now on some heritage sites, and I could name one specifically, which is in the north, which is, I don't know how many golf course holes it is or whatever, but it's being constructed on a pre-Columbian site right now. So this is the level of intrusion that we're at, where policies are not there to uphold it. The Development Control Authority doesn't have anything in place that says, listen, you can't do this. It's private land. All of the conflict is there, Nikita, all of everything. It's, so tourism is our main product. They want to build these condominiums and hotels on our beaches. Our locals get locked out, landlocked. They have no access to the beaches. They have no access to the hotels. The hotels are being built on our sacred ground. That's all I can say.
Oh, my goodness. That's heartbreaking.
Yes, it is. It is. And most of the time it feels like we're losing the battle. But what can we see? What can we do? Just keep up the good fight.
That it's one of those things where, like, it's such the idea of developers coming in, building on beaches, landlocking out locals. I feel like that's happening in so many different places around the world. Mm-hmm. And it's infuriating, because it's almost just like the lack of compassion that is being shown to the people who live in the place and will ultimately work in the buildings and be there. And it's infuriating, and I don't obviously have any answers for it, but it's the developers with compassion, I think, is something that would be needed and is needed around the world, because it can't always just be about making the most money.
Exactly, Nikita. What about the balance? Let's create a balance. Right. And then, do 2,000 acres of land need to be developed all at once? Can you incorporate what's already existing? I understand in some of these developments, they want to throw out people who have been there for 20, 30 years, building their income and building their business from little things. And, you know, like you said, compassion and vision. Let's see how we can work together, how we can preserve. You know, let's not build on the site before conducting an archaeological dig. There are simple, really simple procedures that could take the top off and just stop the pressure. Let's just follow the guidelines. There are international guidelines that say give the residents, I don't know, 2 weeks a month so that they can sort of dig the site and get their archaeological stuff. And we're good. Relocate them. Or decide what to do with them.
Oh, well, I guess we'll start wrapping up. But thank you for so much for jumping on the podcast and sharing more about St. Lucia and teaching me more. I've learned so much already just from our conversation.
Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. I'm excited that, as I mentioned, there's not that many women of color in the preservation field. And recognizing that the U.S. is very young as a country, I'm always excited to talk to others outside of the States to get other preservation perspectives. I remember when I was studying abroad for a little bit, that I came across someone from England who was basically like, we have castles older than your country. You know, you guys treat your historic heritage too precious. I was like, oh, all right. Well, fair, I guess.
Perspective. Oh my God. Wow.
Well, that concludes another episode. Thank you so much for listening.
And remember, historic preservation is a present conversation with our past about our future. We don't inherit the earth from our parents, but we borrow it from our children. So let's make sure we're telling the inclusive history.
Musical selections that you heard throughout the episode are from Sarah Gilberg's album, Other People's Secrets, which is available on Amazon and just about everywhere music is sold.
Quiet morning, quiet mind.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.